Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. On a frigid day here in Wisconsin, we are in the grips of the polar vortex, and our special guest is Mona Charon, who's sitting in the relatively balmy temperatures of Washington, D.C. Mona, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie. I feel like sending you a drone with firewood or something.
It wouldn't make it. See, the drone probably wouldn't get airborne here. So it's what about what is the temperature right now in D.C.?
It's about 25.
It's about minus 25 here in Wisconsin.
Imagine.
50-degree swing. And that's without the wind chill. See, the thing about it is the wind chill is really all that matters. So we're probably about minus 40. It's a lot worse in Minneapolis, but, you know, what the hell? We're here.
Yes.
So you know how bad it is in Wisconsin. Is not only are the bars closed, but the Postal Service announced that they are suspending mail delivery today.
Is that the first time that's ever happened?
You know, I don't honestly know that, but, you know, you go through their whole, you know, neither rain nor sleet nor whatever. Right. They don't mention polar vortex, so they gave themselves an out.
This would
be legitimate. But the hardest thing, and people who follow me on social media probably have seen this by now, the hardest thing is the dogs, because the dogs, I mean, I'm not going out of the house. I mean, that's it. I'm not leaving.
Right.
Although, and it's hard to even get it warm inside the house. I mean, there are certain rooms that have now become no-go rooms because of this.
Oh, gosh, I can imagine. Look, I used to think that that the Midwest, the harsh weather that's normal for the Midwest, was in part responsible for, this is my little sociological theory, you can shoot it down at any moment, but my little sociological theory was that, you know, Midwest nice arises from the fact that the winters are so harsh that if you don't cooperate with your neighbors and be nice, you'll die. Or at least you would in the olden days.
Okay, and, I would attribute it to Midwestern alcoholism, because you know, people say, why the consumption of brandy, I think, in Wisconsin is you know, at epic levels, because what else are you going to do here other than sit inside and drink? So Jim Swift, who joins us, a senior editor at the Bulwark. You're from Ohio,
yeah.
So that which is sort of Midwest, but not like the upper, you know, deep plains polar vortex Midwest.
Not like the Siberia where Charlie's from. Well,
I'm from Cleveland, so we have lake effect snow, and so I'm no stranger to snow. I remember a big blizzard in the mid-90s. I had to deliver my paper out, which was four streets, and it took me 9 hours because we had 4 feet of snow, and I probably netted like $200 in tips that day. It was awesome. But with all the snow blowing you're doing, Charlie, are you like snow blowing your neighbors' driveways too? I mean, is that part of the Midwestern niceness? Because that's what I had to do as a kid, was do the sidewalk and offer to do the neighbors.
It is part of the culture. I don't do it because I'm not that nice. It actually takes me about an hour to do my driveway. It's that long. So, but the snow is over now. We don't have the snow. We got about 12, 14 inches of snow. And I only had to go out three times, and then the polar vortex hit. So it's kind of a double bump. You get hit by the blizzard, and then you go into the complete crazy, insane deep freeze. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, that is why you're a man of such good character, dealing with this adversity.
You don't want to get that could be there might be other explanations. So where do we start today? The president. Okay, by the way, the one thing that I really want to avoid doing is making any foolish comments about global warming during all of this, because that just sort of exposes, because it's like, okay, it's weather. We've had this before. It doesn't, you know, change anything. But of course, the president of the United States is doing that, as well as tweeting out insults to his intelligence community. And maybe that's where I want to start here.
Yes.
The president of the United States taking to Twitter today, the day after his appointees in the intelligence community delivered some pretty, I think, harsh reality checks on the threats the country faces. And the president, rather than, obviously he's not going to stay silent because he's not capable of all of that, insults them, saying that they are naive about Iran and they should go back to school, with, of course, the requisite obligatory misspelling of the word there. So
it's truly, truly, I guess you have to preface every comment about this administration by saying, if this were to happen in any other administration, this would be a scandal that would be talked about for days, weeks. Let's take that as written. But the foreign policy, look, now that we are at a total impasse on domestic policy, I think we are going to see a lot more activity in the foreign policy realm because it's the one area where the president has scope and he has power and he has the discretion to do a lot of what he just wants to do. And so it's interesting to see what kind of pushback he's going to get from within his own administration. And that is what we saw with the intelligence community. They said a few interesting things. First of all, they said that Iran, which, I don't disagree with the president that Iran is a serious threat to the global order and they're great sponsors of terrorism, enemies of ours and all of that. That's true. But it's a separate and discrete question as to whether they are abiding by the terms of the Iran nuclear deal, which we pulled out of. But they didn't. And according to our intelligence and analysis, they are abiding by the terms of the deal, which is in contrast to what the president has said. Further, as we know, the president has been touting his absurd bromance with Kim Jong-un as some kind of breakthrough for peace. And he has said, they're much less aggressive now. It's great. We've fallen in love and so on. And here comes a enormous bucket of ice water from the leaders of the intelligence community, Dan Coats and Haspel at CIA and so forth, saying, no, actually, the North Koreans are not dismantling their nuclear program, and they are not likely to, since they regard it as essential for regime survival. So these are direct contradictions on two very important foreign policy questions. And it remains to be seen how. So, yeah, as you point out, Charlie, the president insulted them. But will he take further action? Are their jobs in jeopardy now for being truth tellers? That much we don't know.
So at what point, though, do you resign? I mean, this has been a dilemma all along. The people who feel that, OK, I'm not serving this president, I'm serving the country. And I'm guessing most of them feel that like they are, somehow, standing athwart the worst impulses of the president. But is there a moment where, some of them need to, just say, I'm sorry. Well, I mean, when General Mattis did it, he kind of broke the glass and said that there are moments when you need to step aside. I'm guessing that most of them have stayed as long as they have because they feel they're actually protecting the intelligence community. So what
would
you advise
them? And not just the intelligence community. They feel they're protecting the country, I would guess. But look, I think most of the sane people in this administration, and there are quite a few, and let's not forget that famous anonymous New York Times op-ed article about how we know what's going on here and we're just hanging in to save the country. But it seems that many have taken the attitude that, look, the president says 15 outrageous things every day, and we're not going to make his more flamboyant and absurd and ignorant comments the basis of our actions. But when he takes actions that we think are actually harmful, mm-hmm. that's another matter. And I think the action that prompted Mattis to finally say, that's it, was the abrupt and poorly planned announcement to just withdraw troops from Syria. And I think it's fair. Dan Coats, by the way, I see him walking his dog in my neighborhood all the time. he's down the street, but he's somebody that I think is a straight shooter. Had a long and distinguished career. I think does not have any reason to be doing this job other than public service. I think if the president were to do something absurd, say with the next summit with Kim Jong-un, something beyond, and admittedly, some of the things that come out of Trump's mouth are themselves actions and are themselves damaging. And we can come back to that in a second. Remind me to talk about Venezuela and the effect there. But But I think if the president were to take some kind of concrete action with North Korea at this next summit, if he were to say, fine, you know, we've reached an agreement and the agreement is some god-awful thing where we basically give away the store, I can imagine that being a circumstance where Coates would say, I'm out.
I think that's a good distinction. I do. But imagine how frustrating it must be. I'm reading the tweet here from Ken Delanian from NBC, who's the national security reporter, who said, senior intelligence officials have said that it is extremely difficult to convince Trump he is wrong about something, no matter how much evidence they can put in front of him. He believes what he believes, which must be both frustrating and terrifying when you're dealing with some of these issues. And so you always wonder, at what point does it go from him just bloviating to an actual action? So give me your take on Venezuela.
Right. Before I do, let me just interject that what you just said, you know, reminds me of the accounts that have been in several of the books that have been written so far, but particularly in Bob Woodward's book, where he gives sort of blow by blow descriptions of the lengthy conversations between Gary Cohn and Trump, where Cohn kept trying to show him the facts about tariffs and how Americans are the ones who pay tariffs, not the Chinese, and on and on. And it was just talking to a brick wall. He could not make progress. Excuse me. But let's talk about Venezuela for a second, because, and this will somewhat contradict, not, I said that many people in the administration seem to take the view that you can sort of shrug off what the president says and go more by what he does. But this distinction can break down, because the president's words are policy in many instances. So, for example, when the president casts doubt on whether or not we will come to the aid of a NATO member like Montenegro, that is not just bloviating. That is not just talk. The entire NATO alliance is founded on deterrence. It's founded on the idea that don't test us. You know, we will respond.
And wars have begun by miscalculation because of imprecise statements like
precisely.
That.
And you know, for example, April Glaspie, remember when she went to see Saddam Hussein, and our ambassador unfortunately made a slip and said that we didn't regard Kuwait as a vital interest of ours. And, you know, he rolled his tanks in soon thereafter. So, yeah, words can have desperately important consequences. Now, people have mostly forgotten about this already, but back in 2017, at one point, in a stray remark, as he makes so many, President Trump said that he could imagine using military force against Venezuela. Everybody forgot about it, but not the Venezuelans. I was interested to note that Michael Moynihan of Vice News was pointing out that when you watch Venezuelan state TV, they repeat that clip kind of incessantly on their state-run propaganda, which has made it much more difficult for the people of Venezuela to rise up against this regime, because to do so is implicitly to be in the employ of or under the thumb of the great Yankee imperialist to the north. And so that is another of many examples one could cite where words have consequences, and his incontinence of the mouth is a dangerous thing.
You know, you mentioned before, just to bounce around here a little bit, the Woodward book with discussing tariffs. I was thinking about that yesterday when we found out that Harley Davidson's entire profit had been wiped out by the increased steel tariffs. And we're starting to see this affect corporate profits, Caterpillar and Apple. And you do wonder, because this seems to be one of his fixed ideas that no one can talk him out of. So we're seeing the consequences of this played out in real time. So all of this seems to, you know, come back to this theory of the relationship between our politics and reality. And you had a great column, and I wanted to talk to you. You said there's an opening for a party of reality. And so let's talk about what's happening with the Democrats. We see all the problems of the Republicans and Donald Trump. And it really strikes me, and this is what you wrote, that the Democratic Party is reading all of this as an opportunity to lurch as hard and fast to the left as possible. And it strikes me as a dubious proposition.
Right. I mean, and this is, you know, part of the problem with the way we nominate and elect presidents is that, of course, we have a primary system now. The old smoke-filled rooms are gone. The smoke-filled rooms were the places where, you know, hard-charging and practical-minded men would, and they were all men, would look at candidates and say, well, this guy can't win, so we're going to toss him aside and so forth. Now, and we arguably both parties would be far better off if they took a more pragmatic view toward nominees. That is, who can win? Who can win the vast middle of the country? But that's not the way it's structured. The people who vote in primaries in both parties tend to be the most energized, the most ideological, and the most extreme. And so it's looking like the Democrats, in order to win the nomination, in order to appeal to those energized people at the extremes, who do really do form a minority of the country, are now singing this unbelievable. Some of them are outright calling themselves Democratic Socialists, not the ones who are running for president, but there are several Democratic Socialists now in Congress. They are, but even those who don't call themselves socialists are proposing just unbelievable amounts of spending. So this Medicare for All proposal that now seems to be de rigueur, that all the Democrats are going to get in line, salute smartly and say, yes, yes, have to have Medicare for All. Although Kamala Harris did retract that a little bit. She walked it back. But you know, some of us have been critical of the Republicans for passing a tax cut that wasn't paid for, or compensated for by countervailing spending cuts. But that added $1 trillion to the debt. The estimates of how much Medicare for All would cost over 10 years is something like $32 trillion.
Yeah.
I mean, we are just talking in a realm of insanity about what is possible for government to do. And, you know, I read a piece by Damon Linker at The Week the other day, and I admire him. I think he's a very, very, very perspicacious writer. But he said something that I very much I see all over on the left, which is and needs to be rebutted. Namely, he said, well, Medicare for All is popular. You know, they keep saying this. Well, yeah, of course it's popular until, you know, we're going to give you free medical care. Government, someone else will pay for it. We'll raise taxes on the rich. Great. Who would not be for that? But of course, when you show people a different poll, when you poll people and you say, well, Medicare for All would cost X amount. It would require we raise your taxes by X amount. It would cause shortages and waiting lines for some medical services. Oh, guess what? Support for that such a plan drops into the teens or low 20s. So, you know, to say, oh, it's popular, this is a ridiculous argument.
Well, and also, David Leonhardt in the New York Times has a really good piece about this, saying this is a trap. You know, first of all, it is extremely dangerous any time you are taking away people's health insurance. I mean, you know, if there's one lesson that both parties ought to have learned, is that if somebody has something and they like it and you take it away, it is bad. And these poll numbers are very dramatic. You know, Kaiser pollsters, you know, asked about, do you favor Medicare for All? And people go, yeah, that's absolutely wonderful. But when they, as you point out, Mona, you know, when they, you know, point out that, you know, understand that Medicare for All wipes out all private insurance, the idea flipped from being popular to unpopular. 37% of respondents favored it, 58% opposed it. So if the Democrats decide they're going to embrace this because they've been seduced by the top lines of the poll, they're in for a terrible reality check next year when people begin to find out, oh, so I do lose all of my health insurance. I lose my choice, and it's going to cost $30 trillion.
Exactly. And, you know, the Democrats are headed, I'm sorry to say, in exactly the wrong direction if they're hoping to defeat Trump, because even reluctant Trump voters in the Republican Party will take one look at a Medicare for All proposal and think, all right, you know, better the devil we know.
I think that's true, and I'm kind of amazed that they are all sort of trooping in that direction. But also, it's an indication that that's why Kamala Harris backed off. So
yes,
I suppose now we're obliged to talk about Howard Schultz, because of course he's getting a lot of attention talking about running as an independent, because we just don't have enough billionaires in politics these days. But he came out and very specifically differentiated himself from this Democratic left, and really in answer to the larger question, why aren't you a Democrat? He says, well, because I'm not in favor of, these massive tax increases. I'm not in favor of a wealth tax. I'm not in favor of socialized medicine. So what do we make of him? I had David Jolly on the other day. He said, this guy is not a spoiler. He's a contender. What do you make of him, Mona?
I heard David Jolly. Love David Jolly. But I have to say, maybe I'm being too cynical, although a friend of mine always says that he worries when he's not being cynical enough. But look, Howard Schultz is nothing like Donald Trump. People say, you say Howard Schultz can't make. Why? Donald Trump was just a businessman and he made it. Well, yes, but he was a reality star on TV. How many voters have ever heard of Howard Schultz? And how many are going to find him a compelling personality in an age when that seems to be more important than ever? Look, I love the idea of a responsible Democrat saying we really need to be worried about the debt. I love that. I hope he runs as a Democrat. I think that would be helpful. But I just don't see where this great groundswell is going to come from. What Jolly is hoping is that all those people out there who are just pining for responsible government will rally to his banner. It reminds me of that old line that this woman who approached, Adlai Stevenson and said, you're the candidate of every thinking man. And he said, yes, madam, but I need a majority.
Yeah, there's a little bit of naivety on this. The only thing that one thing that strikes me is the level of the Democratic freakout, how angry the left is, how angry the Democrats are that there might actually be a third way. To which, let's go back to what we were saying, if you don't want there to be, voices pushing for a third choice, a centrist alternative, you might want to rethink this lurch to the left. You might want to, rethink the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, school of, moving America in a completely different direction, because that's what creates that space in the center, because I can certainly imagine if in fact you have a hardcore left wing Democratic Party up against Donald Trump, I'm going to be open minded about something in the center, even if it is a relatively uncompelling and perhaps naive candidacy.
Right. That's exactly right. And it does occur to me, though, Charlie, that from our point of view, as people who have been highly critical of Trump, that this phenomenon, it's not entirely, you can't lay it entirely at the feet of Trump at all, because Bernie Sanders, after all, ran in 2016 before Trump was president on basically these ideas. So they've been out there. But I do also think, and tell me what you feel about this, that to a degree, the extremism of Trump and the Republicans has driven the Democrats more to their own extremes. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. I mean, I sort of have the sense that the country is going through a political nervous breakdown. And you are in seeing this, that everything becomes more shrill. The more nuanced voters, or even the voters who the political figures who take policy seriously, seem discordant, because we are in this strange age. And you basically point out something as well in your column, that we're now seeing one of the, I think, indications of this is the way that both conservatives and liberals are encouraging victimhood. I mean, that used to be something that was just on the left.
Yes.
And now we see this populist, this populist Tucker Carlson stream of thinking that encourages people on the right to always think that they are victims. And I think that's part of the Trumpification of our politics.
Absolutely. And it's really fascinating to see people who on the right used to welcome the point of view that, for example, the problems of the inner cities of Black Americans were not so much the result of discrimination and racism, but were really the results of problems of behavior, that family structure was highly implicated, that character and work ethic and all of that. And, you know, you could write those columns, and I did for many years, and get nothing but cheers from people on the right. Now, when you say about the white working class who are having very similar problems and pathologies to what we used to talk about in the inner cities, that is family breakdown, drug abuse, disconnection from the workforce, widespread illegitimacy, you find that there's tremendous pushback, and people say, well, you can't blame the victim. And they say it's actually the fault of globalization, or it's actually the fault of those, you know, wily Asians, or it's actually the fault of these immigrants who are taking all the jobs, or
and the elites.
Exactly. And so it's just, I guess it just depends which group you're going to bat for when you, with your unwillingness to ever assign responsibility to those people for their own decisions.
You also used an interesting phrase. You said we are living in a civic cesspool. What did you mean?
Yeah.
Where do you start?
Where do you start?
Our language, our manners, and our hatreds are out of control and out of proportion to our problems. And I also think that that's also part of living in this Trumpian age.
That's right. I mean, there is so much exaggeration of the problems that we face. There's so much catastrophism. Like the Flight 93 election, if Hillary Clinton became president, we were all crashing and burning, which is an absurd exaggeration of the stakes. It wouldn't have been good, but neither was the other outcome as far as that goes. But I don't know whether it is the rise of social media and lack of, so that we no longer have the mediation of big institutions, and we have more the unfiltered voice of the people, which I'm no fan of, by the way. I don't worship the people. Mm-hmm. I think there's nothing more unattractive than a mob. And what we see on Twitter, when people rightly call them Twitter mobs, because when people get their emotions riled up and they have very few facts, they tend to go charging off with their pitchforks and their torches in very bad directions. So I don't know whether it's partly a technological thing. It's certainly the result of poor leadership, but we are in the midst of these endless, vicious, hate-filled contests between identity groups in America. And then nice, right-thinking folks like Steven Pinker keep picking up their heads above the parapet and saying, but wait, things are actually great. Why are you so angry? Why are you so upset?
I think it's technology. An old editor of mine, I wanted to write a letter to a nice subscriber who asked, where did the letters to the editor page go? And you know what he said to me? He said, well, back when we started, the only way to write a letter to the editor was to get on a typewriter or get on a computer, print that off on a piece of paper, buy a stamp, put it in an envelope, and send it in. And now with email, everyone's a critic, and in the information age, the letters over time, on average, just got less and less thoughtful.
True.
I think that's true. But you know what? I also think that there's a modeling, that if at a time you marinate in a world of thoughtful discourse, you're going to try to raise the level of your discourse to be able to participate. On the other hand, if you marinate in an age of Twitter, of sixth grade level bullying, insults, that also lowers the lowers the standard. And one of the things that I've watched is just the fundamental dumbing down on every single level of our ability to reason with one another, the discourse, the language that we use. And that's also, you know, it is a function of the technology, but it is actually changing the character and the culture of the country as well.
I completely agree, and would recommend to anyone that hasn't seen them in a while to go back and watch the Kennedy-Nixon presidential debates, because they're all on YouTube. And the level of, you know, Nixon was considered to be one of the great villains of American history, right? The level of discourse was so high. The expectation of understanding on the part of the audience was so elevated. It's amazing. The detail that they got into about Kamoi and Matsu and all of these various matters. It is a world away from what we have now, where it's so much more about entertainment. And we have literally elected an entertainer. And frankly, those trends were in evidence before Trump. You had, the gradual sort of slide from politics to polytainment, you know, with Bill Clinton appearing on the Arsenio Hall show and talking about what kind of underwear he wore and all of that. And Barack Obama, who most people think conducted himself with a certain amount of dignity as president, but he appeared on a, you know, what was that show where the lady was in a tub of Fruit Loops, or, yeah, you know, yeah. Right?
But that still seems like a kinder, gentler era now.
I still also blame the internet because, I mean, I'm the young guy here on this episode.
So you speak for your entire generation, Jim.
I consider myself wrongly labeled a millennial, but information is a mile wide and an inch deep. And yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, the internet didn't really exist anywhere near the form that it was today. I mean, I kind of grew up with it, but I'm still young enough to remember consulting Encyclopedia Britannica and, you know, people selling them door to door. And that was your repository of knowledge. Now, if you want to have a political debate with someone, they can go find anything on the internet within seconds on their smartphone and say, yeah, but what about this? And with like no real understanding of history or, you know, science or knowledge or whatnot, just throw something back. And, you know, it's maybe the weekly standard was right. Smash the internet.
Well, no. Well, also, I mean, let's face it, that we are wired that way. I think we assume that people use their minds, and I've talked about this before in other venues. You know, they use their minds to find out what is true and what is right, when in fact, perhaps we are wired to strengthen our bonds to our tribe, and the impulse to confirm our bias is so strong. There have actually been studies on this by social psychologists who have found this in Jonathan Haidt's book. Where if you want to believe something, all you need is one piece of data to confirm you in your belief. If you want to not believe something that's inconvenient, like, for example, you know, that Donald Trump is a mendacious con man, you know, as you point out, Jim, now all you need to do is go on your smartphone and you're going to find, you know, somebody who, has the differing, is able to do that spin. So that what's happened is you have this sort of the perfect storm of the way our minds are wired to confront, to engage in motivated reasoning, and a social media ecosystem that feeds that worst impulse, which in a lot of ways is kind of a repeal of the Enlightenment. It is dialing back on all of the years where people that before you developed an opinion, why don't you read a damn book? Why don't you actually think it through? Why don't you think about it for more than 5 minutes? I mean, wasn't that kind of the whole point? Civilization, and now we've wiped it away.
And people bow down before, you know, the all-powerful voice, vox populi, you know, and you're supposed to cater to it and so forth, rather than saying, so for example, sometimes, you know, people would write to me and complain that I had used too many words that they didn't know the meaning of. Yeah. And I wrote back and I said, you know what, when I read someone, Andy Ferguson comes to mind, who uses words I'm unfamiliar with, I want to bow down and say, thank you. You've taught me a couple of new words. That's great. To reproach people for knowing things that you don't know is the worst kind of leveling, right? You should be grateful to them. But there's all too little of that. And there's all too much you know, kowtowing to the, as I say, to the people. But at the same time, and I bet, Charlie, you'll agree with this, at the same time that the country has become so much so marinated in this kind of thoughtless and mindless partisanship, there is a group of us who've become markedly less so. I mean, when I compare myself in 2019 to myself in 2011, there is no comparison. I was such a partisan back then, and I was very much inclined to believe the worst about Democrats and the best about Republicans. And that has just fallen away like, you know, like wax melting off one of those figures in a horror movie. You know, it's just gone. And so I must represent, and I know you're sort of feeling the same thing.
Very much so.
We must represent something. We can't be the only ones.
No, I think that, you know, part of that is disillusioning and disorienting, but then ultimately it's liberating, right?
Right.
Because you look around and you don't have to take your direction from the team. But, you know, I do look back on, you know, times like 2011 and with a little bit of chagrin, you think, oh, man, I was really part of all of that. And all the ways in which you consumed information looking for ammunition rather than information. And I think that may be the change. You know, someone accused me of that back then, and I remember being very offended about it. You know, saying that that one of the problems with talk radio shows like yours is you're always using it as ammunition rather than. And I thought that's just not true. And I look back on it and think, you know, maybe it's not completely true, but it was a lot more true than I would have been willing to acknowledge back then. And so I'm guessing that for a lot of people, however, it is very disorienting to be out here sort of because you don't have handholds. You don't have the comfort and the protection of the tribal certainties. So for a lot of people, it's too disorienting and they don't like it, which is why they rush back into the cocoon. But
opposite party's cocoon.
Well, and we've seen that, too.
Yes.
So, but I have to admit, I like it and I like it a lot. I do.
It is liberating, but it's certainly true that it is scary at the same time. But you know, it does offer a lesson. I mean, yeah, I would agree with looking back on my own work from years past, where I will concede that I was looking for confirmation of a view that I already held. Rather than really taking on the arguments of the other side or, you know, considering what was left out. And it's just Charlie, we have to lead a new movement of people for whom the scales have fallen from their eyes. We need some people on the left to acknowledge that they see that on their side, too.
Yeah. Okay. You and I both know a lot of conservatives who are willing to go through this. I know fewer folks on the left who are willing to do this.
Many fewer.
Well, maybe we can encourage them. Mona, thank you so much for joining me today. Mona Charon.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it very, very much. And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, and still within the polar vortex, but I think we'll be able to do this tomorrow. We'll do it all over again.